Hey, everybody, welcome to another episode. I am Michael Petro, and on the show this week, you've got me sitting down with Zelco Entertainment and one of its co-owners, David Zelis. I was interested in finding out how the film distribution world works. That's exactly what Zelco Entertainment does. They take films that have been lost and need a home, that may not have a big showing, but still are worth a watch, and they want to get it out to the masses. So I get to talk about how he got a start in film, how distribution works, how it works in Canada, the roadblocks for small independent films trying to get their films out there, and a ton more. Dave is very knowledgeable. He's not as old as he thinks he is, and he was a great time to talk to. So that's who's on the show for you this week. If you've ever been interested in film distribution, or you're a filmmaker and you're curious and you have no idea, that's why this episode occurred, to educate me and maybe educate one or two other people. And if that happens, well, then we've done our mission here at the Real Debaters Podcast. So that's who's on the show. That's what's on the show. April 27th, ladies and gentlemen, the Real Debaters are back doing another live event. This time it is trivia. Yes, we're going to do three rounds of general movie knowledge trivia. So this is for people who watch movies but aren't cinephiles. This is designed for you guys, the normal everydayers, the not obsessed ones who want to come out, have a couple beers at Little Brown Jug, because that's where it is in Winnipeg, and have some fun with us. We're going to have four of us on stage reading out questions. We're going to have a bunch of us in the crowd interacting with you guys, maybe doing impressions, commenting on shit, and we're also going to have prizes. So April 27th at Little Brown Jug in Winnipeg, Manitoba. Check the show notes. It will be there. Tickets are $5 at the door. Show up early. I believe it's a 7 o'clock showtime. If you want to confirm that, send us a DM on our Instagram, Facebook, or Twitter. I'll have all that information for you. But April 27th is the date. So mark it on your calendar and subscribe to the show, because then you'll always be in the know and you won't ever miss out. And you'll be like, damn it, you're right. I need to make a team. Teams of six, I believe, are max. That'll also be confirmed closer to the date. We want to get as many people in as possible to have as much fun as possible. So get your trivia hats on, ladies and gentlemen. We'll see you April 27th at Little Brown Jug. I have nothing else for you this week. So without further ado, I give you David Zelis, finding all about the film distribution world. I will cue that reel, and you enjoy the show.
Let's tidy up this tangle of film by putting it on a reel. Here is a motion picture film, 1,000 feet, 16,000 separate photographs.
Welcome, everybody.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Real Debaters Podcast. Welcome back to the show. I have kicked out every normal voice, every known voice that you've heard, and I'm sitting. I always do this. I didn't ask you how you pronounce your last name, so we'll start with the first name. I'm sitting with David
Zelis.
It's from Zelco Entertainment, and this gentleman and me, we've been like liking each other's posts and kind of trying to build our Twitter or TikTok feeds. Is I think where we kind of found each other.
Yeah, TikTok.
Fucking TikTok. It's the devil. It really sucks your brain.
It breeds a certain, kind of person on the platform.
So,
if you've been following Andrew Tate, if you know what.
Yeah, fuck that guy. Oh, my God. All of a sudden, one day I woke up and he infected my feed. And, like, I don't watch, I know I don't watch that stuff.
Yeah.
It just, I don't know. It's the algorithm.
But it's to not get out of topic here, but it's a thing where, because I'm fascinated by these grifters, and that's what he is.
Yeah.
He basically sells this course, quote unquote, called, some kind of, Alpha Chad nonsense.
Alpha Chad, I love it.
But it's a very kind of MLM, mid-level marketing kind of scheme where, pay this course and he encourages you to share these clips of him saying like this kind of, nonsensical wisdom.
Yeah.
So it'll really just kind of flood the algorithm on TikTok. So you can't get away from it.
Oh, that's interesting.
That's the grift, right?
Oh yeah. I fucking swipe up. Anyway. So yeah. So how we met was you were doing your what was it? The posters, each poster I think was your bit for a minute that I was following that I liked.
Yeah, no, I think...
I'm off it now. That's the reason I'm saying I haven't followed anything for a while.
Oh, no. I was talking to my business partner today about this and just talking about this podcast when I was going to be on it. And I was just looking at the Instagram, and I think you had mentioned A Desperate Road as one of the films we represent.
Yes. Crystal Snow, Cameron Patterson?
I think he goes by Cam Patterson.
That's his book name.
yeah, so you had posted on it and said, thanks, and... I understand you've had Cam on the show previously, was trying to get, you know, some of the other filmmakers on the show to talk about it. And you said you're interested in knowing kind of what I do. And
yeah, I'm fascinated by it because I started this with like, let's talk about movies. And then I'm like, I don't know shit. I really don't know shit about the business side and the creative side and the post side. I know how to compare and contrast and be a fan, but distribution to me has always been a puzzle. So as we talked, yeah, I was like, man, I want to know how it works. I want to know how it works in your world, the ups, the downs, the ins and outs and all that stuff. And the thing that we do here on the show is we don't know where we're going unless we know where you've been and how you got into film. So let's start with some backstory on you, bud. How did film enter your life?
Yeah, I mean, I probably entered my life when I got accepted into film school.
Okay.
This is like going back years. And at the time, I grew up in, you know, East Kildonan and North Kildonan's fairly blue-collar neighborhood.
Same, dude.
And there you go. Something in common. That's great. So I grew up there and, you know, was generally drinking with your buddies, hanging out on the weekend type thing.
That's what we do in that area, definitely.
It's very true, yeah. Get up in the morning, fix your pickup truck, beer in hand.
Go to the villa, get another case.
Go to the villa, yeah. Remember that floozy anyways. But, yeah, so I grew up there, and, you know, I didn't really know what I wanted to do with my life. And you're a kid. You generally don't. You're in high school. So I'd applied to plumbing, I think, at Red River.
Okay.
All my friends were going off to do blue collar kind of jobs, and applied to film school as well too. And I mean, I never really kind of known the film process previous to that. Didn't get into plumbing, but got into film school. And then, you know, I was always good at writing, or I liked writing, I should say, and did some acting classes and stuff like that in high school. My first foray into film was through film school. Like, I mean, I didn't know anything about how to make a film until I got into film school. So, you know, there's a lot of people that, like, make films when they're young. That was not my experience, however.
No,
not at all. I mean, I liked watching movies. I liked going to...
No,
like,
Steven Spielberg wanting to crash the train over and over again.
Yeah, no, that wasn't me. I went to some... I mean, you know, I was, like, a lazy kid. I went to acting classes because my parents were trying to get me active, basically.
Ah, acting, yeah. Active. Yeah, there sure. What'd you think of that side? How long did that go for?
The acting classes? I mean, it's fine, you know? I mean, I'm capable of it. It's not something I've really pursued. Respect for people that do it, obviously.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, and like the more I talk about it, the more I'm like, yeah, acting isn't just talking. It's listening. Acting isn't just, you know, knowing your lines. It's knowing where the camera is. It's knowing your cues. Like, you get so lost in becoming somebody, but then also knowing, like, the mechanics of it. Like, yeah, it's not for me either.
Yeah, well, you have to know your mark and all that kind of stuff. There's a lot of technical aspects I think people don't really think about it. Of course, when I was younger, kind of being an actor in a movie or TV show, that was, like, the thing,
that
right?
That was the goal.
Now it's, like, you know, being the next person that's big on TikTok or whatever, right? It's
fucking annoying.
I mean, you know, I'm not young anymore. It's just a different generation. So, I went to film school.
Where'd you go? You've dubbed?
No, I went to Thunder Bay.
That's right. You were saying you did go all the way to Thunder Bay.
Confederation College, which...
Was there a reason you wanted to leave town or...
I think it was just, you know, they didn't really have a film program here in Winnipeg at the time. I mean, U of W didn't have one. U of M was more like film theory. This was like how to make a film.
Yeah.
And it's a great course. They still run it there. And it was very involved in, you know, you are making a film. You had to make, I think, 3 or 4 films throughout 2 years.
That's a lot.
It was good. It was a really good course. If you want to, like, work on film or primarily work on film, I think, was the kind of concentration as being, like, a cameraman or lighting or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
But you had to crew other people's films. I don't know. It just it was a really great experience. Tight-knit group of people, you know. Some I still talk to this day. Many have, unfortunately, lost contact with, went on to do other things with their lives.
Yeah, yeah.
It's hard to, you know, keep a career in this industry. But it was really good. And just thinking of my professor, it's kind of a funny story. It's not related to anything, so I apologize.
Don't, dude. Tangent away, please.
Tangent away. Anyways, our professor, one of them, was a gentleman named Donald DeLorme. He's still out there doing stuff to this day. And he was from Quebec, but he had spent time in Mauritius. because his wife was from there.
Where is that? I'm sorry, I'm ignorant.
It's in the Caribbean.
Okay.
Yeah, right. So in around the Caribbean. Don't quote me on
Caribbean
that.
Adjacent.
Caribbean adjacent, let's just say that, yeah. So anyways, there was this one kid in our class, Kevin Falkingham. And he,
what's up, Kevin?
Yeah, I don't know what happened to him.
Okay.
Flunked out like after the first semester. And this is like the first day, and he's got this weird accent. It's like Caribbean mixed with Quebecois.
Ho.
And yeah, so anyway.
In theory, that seems like we would have a communication breakdown.
Yeah, so he was an interesting character. And then the first day, he's reading the names, and then Kevin Falkingham was this guy who'd never show up half the time. He goes, and he liked to hit the ganja, let's just say. So he's reading the names. He goes, Kevin Fuckingham? Kevin Fuckingham? These are like a bunch of 18-year-old kids, right? And he just kept saying it over and over again. We're all looking at each other like, not sure what to make of it.
Do we tell him?
And I don't know if he was doing that intentionally or, you know, just needed to go and take a toke outside. I'm not really sure. But anyways, film school was really great. So I was there for a bit over 2 years.
What was your exit film? What was your final assignment?
I was really into Adbusters. It was a magazine back then. I don't know if it's still around.
I vaguely remember it.
Yeah, so it was kind of like, you know, knocking on or satirizing corporate culture or activism type stuff.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's what it was. Yeah, it was the satirical version of corporate
ads and stuff like that.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
So anyways, I did kind of a commentary, kind of like a ad, fake ad on, you know, kids working in sweatshops. Yeah, it was, I don't know. I mean, I look back on it now and you're learning and it's like, I didn't really kind of turn out to what I envisioned at the time.
Our first episode sucks fat dog shit. I'm taking them down. Listener, you got like another week and they're all gone. We're going to be like 20 and up instead of 10 to 20.
You guys, you better download them and remix them on YouTube.
Please do. Please use it in your videos. I'm totally fine with it. Anyways, go on.
Yeah, so that was my, I guess, film that I made. Thesis film, they would have called in the last year.
Yeah.
First year was a bit of a struggle, admittedly, you know, learning everything. And
do they just throw everything? Like, I mean, I know a lot of people, like a lot of my friends have gone to film school, but I've never really asked them, like, what is your day-to-day like?
Well, I think every film school is different. I don't know what Ryerson is like, although it's a kind of a well-known film school in this country, because it's in Toronto, right? A lot of population, all that kind of stuff. We were, like, the little scrappy school, because there would be, like, a film student competition in Ontario every year. And we'd always get some of their films in, and it was always up against the films from Ryerson. Like Ryerson was like, you know, like they're the big shots. But for us, it was all very hands-on, which was great. Like, this is going back like long time. So you'd learn how to shoot on film, 16mm.
Okay.
You'd learn how to edit on a Steenbeck, like actual film.
Like really?
This is going back like, I don't want to say, I'm going to eat myself here. So going back a number of years, but we were the last class that went from analog, so cutting on film, to
digital,
right? So we were the last class to
actually. Oh, you're riding that way? Wow. Yeah. So like digital cameras were fucking huge, I imagine.
No. I mean, the film cameras are fairly large. I mean, the 16mm is not as bad as the 35. Those are like the very large cameras.
Yeah.
Large cameras.
So you used, like, I saw, like, the machine you're speaking of. What's it called again, sorry?
We used the Steenbeck.
A Steenbeck. So I think I've seen one of these. It's in the Orson Welles Other Side of the Wind thing where it's in the background of the documentary, and he's editing on it, and it looks like it's this machine that feeds the film through.
Yeah, you'd go from, like, very simply, your film would go from left to right.
Okay.
You'd have the reel here on one side, the reel here on the other side. You'd have a screen in front of you. We would project it onto the screen. You'd have a control go back and forth, right? And before, you know, we have all these frame rates that we do now. This was 24 frames per second. So you would literally see the image, like a photo, right?
Yep.
On your film. And, you know, you would cut it. You could cut frames out and stuff like that. It gets very tricky when you start bringing in the sound.
Sure.
Because the sound has to be the same length as the film, right? And then you eventually split your sound into different soundtracks. So you have like dialogue tracks and stuff like that. They still do that. The concept's very much the same in digital. It's just a lot more manageable. Let's just say when you're working analog and something goes out of sync, you could spend like, you know, hours trying to fix it.
Yeah.
Right? Whereas digital, it's, you know, generally...
You can fudge a lot.
Maybe you can still run into issues, but it's not as... You don't have that tangible element in front of you where, you know, maybe your film unspools on the floor and you're spending, you know, all night doing this.
Getting it back oh, my God. That's cool, man. Like, I mean, the reel came out of the fact that everything, like in the name, came out of the fact that everything was shot on one. That's how we started, right? So
yeah,
if we're going to argue film, we got to acknowledge where we came from to where we are now.
Yeah, so, yeah, I mean, that's what we learned on in terms of film school is like. So it was all very hands-on. You'd crew other people's films. Sometimes there's arguments about, you know, equipment being rented out and stuff like that, or who had which camera, or, you know, had the better camera and stuff like that.
What was the one camera everybody wanted to use?
I think we had some Arriflexes. I think we had an SR. It's kind of very popular. Because if you know this, you might know this, like back then, even up until like the 2000s, a lot of TV was shot in 16mm.
Yes, I do know that.
So that was
16 by 9.
Yeah, very common. And then you would have to do the post and everything, and you'd have to like I think it was like you have to do two major roles on somebody else's film. It's like cameraman or editor, or I think we edited our own films. I'm just going back a while. But yeah, and then you have a finished film, but you did learn a lot there. But primarily, it's based on working on film, the production side, the post production side. There was a few other courses that were kind of mandatory.
They were making filmmakers. They weren't just teaching film.
They were, I would say, sure, but I think it was more so they're teaching you to be a crew member there. That's what it felt like.
Okay.
Yeah. That was the main focus. You know, some people I went to film school with, they're doing creative stuff, not necessarily doing film stuff.
Sure. Yeah. So. Yeah. No, you can parlay it a lot, right? Because everybody wants to record something. So knowing film, I mean, you know, lighting, you know, if you know the four or five basics, I mean, that's a life skill, essentially.
Yeah. So, I mean, that was film school. It was a great experience. But in terms of like where it really took off, the kind of filmmaking and, you know, making films for me, is when I got out of film school, I did an internship at the Winnipeg Film Group, which everybody in the city knows.
Good group.
A lot of people are aware of its very long history. But I was there as an intern, intern production coordinator. So it was the person who basically helped the members get the equipment.
Yeah.
You know, all that kind of stuff. And yeah, just met a lot of other creative people. And, like, you know, ended up working with them, you know, produce some of their short films, or they helped me, or vice versa. So it was, like, just a great community to get into.
Yeah.
And I think the thing that most made me kind of continue or, I don't know, whatever, or just, like, this is really amazing, was so, you know, I was there and this intern just doing a bunch of different things. And the distribution coordinator at the time you would send tapes, VHS tapes, off to film festivals. She got me to make dubs of these films by a guy named John Pays. And John Pays is this really well-known filmmaker, kind of like at the same time as Guy Madden. But, you know, I think his films are just incredible. And just made dubs and started watching these films. And, was floored that he had shot this one film, Crime Wave, very well-known film here in Winnipeg, and I think amongst cinephiles across the world. He was from East Kildonan, and he just shot it in his backyard. And to me, that was just incredible.
You know, when you hear them say, just get a camera and shoot, you're like, you can't, you can, but you can't. But, like, when you hear stories like that, it's like, yeah, you just got a camera and you shot it.
Yeah, and it's interesting. You know, we'll get into kind of the distribution side of things, but... just because of that film came out in 1985 and the Sam Raimi film Crime Wave came out. And
a little Catch the Wave there?
Yeah, not quite. you know, I don't know if you're familiar with the film, but I recommend it. It's, I don't know how to describe it. It's maybe one of the best films about filmmaking, my opinion.
Really?
Yeah, and maybe that's just because I'm biased. I'm from Winnipeg, all that stuff. But
hey, good film's a good film. I mean, yeah, location, yeah, I get what you're saying.
Yeah, so John Pays, who's also in the film, he plays the main character, is a color crime writer. This is code for filmmaker.
Okay.
And so he can come up with beginnings and ends of his stories, but he can't come up with the middles.
The big second act.
Yeah, it's a bit on the surreal side. I mean, if you look at films like Wes Anderson and stuff like that, you could maybe compare it to that, although this came before Wes Anderson.
He is Wes Anderson.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. Maybe Wes Anderson drew inspiration from him. I'm not really sure. But it's just like a very weird, very humorous film. I think they just played the director's cut at Cinematheque like just a few weeks back.
Nice.
But yeah, so that was, you know, like a big foray into like, you know, continuing on the film, and met like a bunch of creative people that, you know, necessarily weren't always filmmakers, but there was some, you know, cross-pollination of maybe they were a musician or maybe they were a puppeteer or a video artist or whatever.
In the world of creative types, you're in a playground of so many different colors.
Yeah, and just because I think of the film group is, you know, funded by Arts Council, so you're meeting a bunch of different kind of like people that are more focused on the art.
Yeah.
Than they are kind of
speaking with the camera and using sound and lighting and imagery that might not be so popcorn and on the nose.
Yeah, yeah. So it was great. I mean, that was really kind of like, I don't know, I think a long-winded answer to your question about how the film journey started.
My favorite kind, man.
Right, fair enough.
So, like, you film school, did you crew? Did you work sets in between at all? Because I grew up being in front of the camera on stage. I was dancing, I was singing, I was acting, but I've always liked how it's all done, right? I can be out front, I can be loud and idiotic and command a presence, but I've never been fascinated with being out there and being on the stage and being the front and center, which is funny because this, right? Like,
sure,
whatever.
Sure.
But distribution, I feel, is behind the scenes, right? It's the side of film. It's like the dark side of the moon. Not a lot of people know what's back there.
Yeah. Well, I mean, to start off, the first part, I did work on a lot of crews.
Okay.
Volunteered at the film group. Mostly independent, small stuff. I found, I would sometimes get daily calls for the bigger movies, and I've been extras on there and stuff like that. And I don't know, just the kind of, everyone's from, you know, not necessarily everyone's Hollywood, but there's like, you know, a bunch of producers running around. It's all very stressful.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I did a few of those here and there. I think it was assistant production manager for like, not a Hallmark movie, a lifetime ago, it feels like.
Potato, potato.
Yeah. And then I ended up working in a bunch of other different type of industries. Like, I worked in insurance for a number of years. Because, I mean, you know, Winnipeg is, like, we don't necessarily have the hub that Toronto or a Vancouver or even a Los Angeles has, right? So it can be very tough to stay in this industry here.
Up until maybe 12 years ago, I mean, it wasn't. It was three films a year.
Mm-hmm.
There was a group. They're tier one. They got it first. And then you're
sure
being a plumber going into insurance, right? Like, you got
yeah, exactly.
You can't wait for the show. With the credit and everything in this province pulling it all now, and now they're sending envoys to, you know, Hollywood to say, hey, come film here. Super cheap. But you're right. Like, the stress level of those, I've never been on one of those sets. Mm-hmm. I've worked with those calibers at work. Oh, man, the pace. It's not fun.
Yeah, no, it's a very challenging thing. And I mean, I still have some colleagues who are doing it still. Like, one of my colleagues is in Winnipeg now. He's a digital intermediate technician, which is like short form for a camera assistant, basically.
Okay.
But it's like, because they don't shoot on film, it's all on hard drive, so he manages the data. Stuff, which is very stressful, because if...
Call me a janitor, or I'm a master of the custodial arts.
Yeah, it's very stressful, because you're dealing with like all the data of the film itself.
Oh.
Yeah, so...
So you're around, you're crewing, you're doing your, and like, I mean, it sounds like where you are is great, because it's like when it's for the art instead of for the commerce, it's more genuine, right? It's more lasting. I imagine there's a certain zhuzh that isn't there when it's this insanity of a set.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I mean, I've always been like, just kind of, I've gravitated towards these independent films. Granted, you know, they don't have huge budgets or stuff like that. But generally, because it's just friends and it's like the same mindset, and you're just kind of maybe enjoying your time a bit more.
Yeah.
I've worked on some insane independent films, not to say that there's like some that are like, you know. Okay.
It's not all wine and roses.
Yeah, yeah. But I started out doing crews. I wanted to be, at the time, a camera person to some capacity. So I tried to get in the union, all that stuff didn't really happen. You know, there's the reality of making a living and all that kind of stuff.
Yep.
But I didn't really do that. And then in terms of distribution, I mean, I guess I can start getting into that now because that's like, you know, that just feels like ages ago. And I'm not as involved in the production side of things really at all.
When does a crack at this side of the business start? What's unfolding? When is this? Where is this?
Okay, so just so you know, Zelko Entertainment is a business partner and myself, just to clarify that. I'm a bit more open.
Who's the other side?
His name is Craig.
What's up, Craig?
Gabosh, and a very talented editor, post-production person. But I'm more prone to being okay on interviews and stuff like that. he's a very smart, very talented individual. And he's been around probably longer than I have. But in terms of distribution, we entered this competition. This is going back like 10 years now.
Okay.
It just put over here. It was called Cineku. That was the name of it. And so it was kind of like American Idol for filmmakers. And this was a Canadian competition.
Interesting.
Cineplex had sponsored it. The guy who ran it, his name was Jay Jolie. I think he's still around doing stuff. Wolf Cop was the one to win it the first time around.
Okay.
If you're familiar with that movie at all.
What's that movie about? I like the title.
It's about a
guy who's a wolf and he's a cop.
Cop that's a werewolf.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Sweet.
It was shot in Saskatchewan, actually.
Nice. Yeah. It's not Jonathan Landis. Got it.
No, it's not. Not. Oh my God, I can't remember the guy's name. I know the guy too.
If a werewolf was a cop, man, that's just a whole other level of law enforcement.
Yeah, they made a sequel to it too. Actually, I think you can find that movie quite easily, like on any streaming platform. Like, anyways, but we were in this competition, and we were going to make this movie, Dark Forest. And we didn't get very far in the competition, but we just decided to go out and make this movie. And I won't go and say my opinion on the movie because you never, you know, never materialize to what you maybe want them to be.
Yeah.
Sorry. But we went out and made this movie anyways, and then shot in 2013, 2014. So 2014, we had a finished film, and like most of these kind of independent films, your first effort, they're generally, you tend to be on the shorter side, so this is like 70 minutes with credits. And we did like a crowdfunding campaign. We're successful in that. It funded the production of the movie.
Nice.
Craig, my business partner, edited it, and he's very skilled. So end of 2014, we had a finished movie, and so we wanted to try to figure out, what do you do with it, right? So the people I work with, were fairly knowledgeable. And just give me a second here.
All good.
Clear my throat. Sinus infection.
Oh, Jesus. I had one of those for a month.
Yeah, it doesn't seem to go away.
No, they yeah.
Anyway, so we, I think is good for rented distribution. So there's film markets out there, right?
And let's start with, how does it work? Treat me like I don't know shit, because it's film distribution to me. There's certain things that just take a while for them to click in my brain because of how it's formed, and I don't understand it on my best day.
It's no one really understands film distribution. There's that famous saying, nobody knows anything. And that does apply to that. I think that comes from film distribution. It's
okay.
Very true, right? I can say, do this and it's going to happen, but it's not necessarily the case. I can just kind of share my experience with you.
Sure. Yeah.
What we did.
Yeah.
So we went down to the American film market. And so the American film market is a very, very interesting place. It's ran Santa Monica every November. You have a lot of distributors out there. And
this is like a conference they all come, or
I don't know how to explain it. There's
Is this Mecca for film distribution?
I'm trying to find a nice way to put this. Like, film festivals, in my opinion, you know, things like Toronto and Sundance, like, they're, you know, everyone's talking about them, right? But, you know, the smaller festivals, you know, might be good, but in its essence, they're selling tourism, right?
The big festivals?
Not the big festivals. Well, you kind of like the mid-range festivals. You know, there's good festivals out there, don't get me wrong.
Yep.
But in essence, even the big festivals, all the festivals, they're selling tourism, right?
Yeah.
Tourism to come to that location.
Yep.
Film markets, I feel, are not much different in that way.
Okay.
I mean, who doesn't want to go to, like, you know, California in November, right? It's very nice there.
Yeah.
But you go there and you'll see all these posters for, you know, movies with Eric Roberts, Clint Howard, you know, an actor you don't remember from ever. Oh, he was on that 80s TV show, right?
Yeah, he did that one. He was with Fonzie on the Happy Days. Yeah.
Yeah, so you see all these posters for these kinds of films, right? So it's very interesting. And what we found is, like, you're going to go there. And so this is a distribution thing that's become a myth. I think it was, like, reality maybe 10, 15 years ago. You would go to these markets. You'd have a film. You try to get what's called an MG, which means minimum guarantee.
Okay.
Right? So you'd sell it to someone. They say, we're going to pay you, I don't know, $20,000 for your film.
Okay.
Because then they're going to go ahead and then they're going to, you know, sell it and make that money back on their end, right?
And then some.
And then some, right. But, you know, what we found is there's a lot of shysters at this particular market. And I think that's kind of true amongst a lot of kind of these markets.
Where people are bearing their blood, sweat, and tears after they've put a lot of work into something. There's a lot of ability to take advantage of that, I would imagine.
Yeah, well, you got to realize these distributors, not all of them, but some of them are building their catalog so they can sell their company.
Oh, really? It's just an investment to sell, not...
Which is kind of... Like, you have to be very careful, right? So we were offered a contract, which was very bad, and we didn't sign it. But there, you know, the good thing about the American film market is there's, like, conferences and stuff you can go to. And I forget the woman's name, but she was kind of like a marketing expert. And she said, you know, if you see a contract, a distribution contract says, you know, marketing, we're going to pay our marketing expenses first before you see a percentage, don't sign it. And in essence, what these companies are doing is their marketing expenses are their trip to cons, their whatever, their overhead and stuff like that, right?
Yeah.
And they can justify their marketing expenses and you can never see a dime from your film.
So that's where stories like Return of the Jedi go into, you know, the red, because the marketing took forever. It cost so much money. The film never gets paid.
Yeah, in essence. I wouldn't.
I personally wouldn't use that as an example
because that's, like, such a large film and they're, like, such, like, you know, team of accountants and stuff like that. But yeah, so I mean, maybe a better example from what I see is sometimes you would see, like, a movie on DVD or VHS or whatever.
Yeah.
And it's just gone, like, you know, it's like a bad pan and scan transfer, or it's really crappy because it's been sub-licensed so many times.
Oh, so it's a copy of a copy of a copy of a copy.
Yeah, it's just, you know, whatever. It's like it just keeps going through these different hands and, you know, you get something with very bizarre cover art. You know, you've always seen, like, a movie and you might see, like, a movie where the cover art's, like, nothing like the actual movie itself.
Sure, totally.
Right? So some distributors have in their clauses, like, we can change the promotional materials, right?
But why?
Well, it depends on the distributor, because they just, you know, sometimes I'll say, like, sometimes we get posters that are not that good, and so we will change them.
Oh, okay. I get it. So it's still the same. It's still the same poster for the movie. It's just a different version. It's like the European version of the poster, right?
Sure. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Sometimes that's kind of, like, built into the contract.
Interesting. Okay. All right.
Right. So sometimes you see different cover art because they think, like, you know, I could really get into the tangent of posters.
Please.
I see some of the posters there, and I saw a documentary, and there's a style of that kind of poster. I forget what it's called. Where these kind of, like, artists will take the existing poster and then, like, make their own version, basically.
Yeah, like fan art.
Yeah, there's a different
name. But there's a better name for it.
Yeah. Well, no, there's, like, a certain... I can't remember the name. I watched a documentary about it, like, a little while back. But in terms of, like, you know, distributors, all that kind of stuff, so... Going back to the American film market, reel myself in here, you know, all the offers we got were just, like,
garbage,
trash, right? So you kind of go, and it's like, that was a great experience being there, going to a film market, seeing what it's like.
And this is you, hat in hand, walking around, meeting people, shaking hands, trying to strike up a conversation and be like, pick me. That's ballsy, man. I appreciate that.
The way it works is there's a lot of filmmakers there, and you hear different stories and, you know, different
years. Fucking the rumor mill there must just be insane.
Yeah. I mean, you know, you do have, like, agents and stuff doing conferences and stuff like that, so that's very interesting. But the way it works at the American film market, that might have changed because of the pandemic, but when we were there in 2014, it's in a hotel in Santa Monica, so just right, I don't know if you've been to California before.
Unfortunately, not yet.
Okay. Well, hopefully one day we'll both
tease me,
there,
tell me.
Go to the American film market and, you know, sell our film with Eric Roberts in it. Who knows? but anyways, so it's set up so these distributors will rent rooms in the hotel.
Like conference rooms. Okay, yeah, yeah.
No, like hotel rooms.
Oh.
Right,
oh.
Hotel rooms. They're in hotel rooms. So these distributors are in hotel rooms, and then you would try to set up meetings before the conference or before the market. Or if not, you just go around and you talk to them and say, you know, I've got a film, blah, blah, blah. You know, the distributors you could tell that were genuine would just be very upfront with you. It's like, you know, this is a very hard thing to sell because it's regional. That's generally how it goes.
Yeah.
You know, unless you had like a name or there's some.
Like when you say regional, it would be like these two states that they'll probably distribute it in? Or are you saying regional?
Regional filmmaking. Okay. So this film is made in Winnipeg. You know, people who are worked on it are going to watch it, for example.
Okay.
Why would people outside of where you've made it in your hometown be that interested, really?
Wow, that's harsh.
It's the reality.
It is the reality. Right? Yeah, it is. Yeah, that's the nice way of saying it.
Right. So there's a term that goes around, regional filmmaking, right? So
okay.
That's kind of what that refers to. But yeah, we didn't make any sales from it, so we bought it back. And this would have been 2015. And we just knew some of the people at the town cinema, like the managers and stuff like that.
Okay.
And so
rest in peace.
Yeah, man. What a,
that was hard. We'll talk about that.
Yeah. Very sad about that. Yeah. Place I love to go.
You said anymore. A dark forest, right? I want to bring it up here. So I'm,
yeah, dark forest, though. I think there's like another full moon movie that comes out, like on the IMDb, if you're, that's where you're looking. So we talked to the people at the town cinema, and we were going to comic cons at the time to promote this.
Okay,
like
nice
in Regina and here in Winnipeg when it was C4 and it was very disorganized. It's much better now.
Oh, so sure. They're so great. We've done it 2 years in a row.
Did you ever deal with the C4 people?
No, I wasn't cool then, and I didn't have the show, but I could just feel the C4 show did not have a sense of organization.
Yeah, that's putting it very diplomatically.
I try.
yeah, so we were promoting Comic-Con and stuff like that. So when we were back here in 2015, we had this film. We talked to the town cinema. We ended up talking to their booker at Landmark.
Okay.
And they arranged it.
Nice.
And yeah, we played August 2015. It played for 3 weeks at the town cinema, something we're very proud of. It did very well for the 3 weeks it played. And I mean, a lot of that is cause you know, like cast and crew and stuff like that, getting friends and family out.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just bugging people to go see it, but they let us like, I mean, the town cinema, the two managers there, Jane and Bong, were just great to work with. But they let us kind of like the week before promote it, they would play the trailer in front of the other movies.
Nice.
So they did all these kind of things. And then we just started, we got some other theaters across Western Canada to play it. Yeah. And then we did find a distributor eventually. Not us, where it's back in our, like we are distributing it now. But they were fine to work with too. And they put it on a lot of the platforms that it was on, like Amazon and stuff like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And so that's kind of where it started, out of necessity really.
So you found distribution by having to distribute your own film.
Yeah. And I mean, that's more common than you think. You know, the filmmakers that are savvy will generally tend to do that.
There's so much business,
sure,
to this that it amazes me how many hands it transfers through and how many times it can go around. And if like you make a thing, you can distribute it in perpetuity as many times as you want. Like it's not just this 2 hour pretty picture.
Yeah. Well, getting back to the kind of American film market and the contrast you kind of want to be wary of, and this is sometimes what happens is certain films get lost, or the, you know, just the original rights holders of the film kind of get screwed because they just signed a bad contract. And talking to American filmmakers, because they're more litigious down there, like I've heard so many just like horror stories of, you know, I signed with these people, they were just the worst to work with. There's one gentleman who, I'm on these like various online groups on Facebook or whatever.
Yeah.
With filmmakers. And one gentleman was like, you know, I signed, he had a film with Lin Shaye in it. Who's like in the Conjuring movie. I think she's in the Conjuring movies. I could be wrong. But yeah, he had this movie with Lin Shaye in it. And I signed with his company and never paid him a cent. And he had to go after them. And he was like suffering from cancer at the same time. So you just hear like all these just like nightmare stories, especially when it's in the kind of world of, you know, films with maybe not huge or large budgets.
Well, yeah, and that's the breeding ground for the sharks, right? Because mm-hmm. you don't have a sure footing yet. So that's you keep saying like how the American film industry is specific to, you know, the American people, I guess. It's like there's 300 million people down there making content in that market. I mean, it's saturated, it's heavy. Mm-hmm. Everybody wants a big home run. It's America where you can get your picture, you know, seen by everybody. The Canadian side, what's Canada like? What have you, like, what are we missing that maybe the American side has that we should have up here? Or
well,
what do we lack? Like, where do they compare?
Yeah, I mean, there could be debates to be about that endlessly. In America, they don't have the funding system we have up here. So they kind of have to let the free market decide. Now you can say if that's good or bad. But here for us, I can just say that, you know, we've had six, and I don't know why this is. This kind of infuriates me to some degree. But we've had more success putting our particular Canadian films on American platforms that are available in Canada. They may be selling to, you know, a Canadian broadcaster.
Yeah.
Something to that effect. So, you know, there's that. And here in Canada, just because I think they let the free market decide there, and not every filmmaker is super educated about distribution. I mean, I feel like we're still learning ourselves. And we try always to be knowledgeable on top of things. Everything changes, like, every day. but... you know, there in America, you know, they tend to be more aggressive, more in your face. You know, a thing that's like, we have this product, we put money into it, we want to make it back. The way the funding system works here, not all the films we have were necessarily funded by the government. Some of them are self-financed. And let me hit the mic there. You know, maybe the attitude's a bit different up here. The population is lacking, as you had mentioned. And, you know, there's some films that we do have that were financed by a certain government organization, and there's not maybe an incentive to, you know, kind of get the back. I'm all for arts for art's sake, but at the same time, you know.
The risk that the Americans take, there's the reward, right?
Sure. And there could be here reward too, but, you know, if you get money to make your movie. And I mean, some of these government organizations do ask that you pay them back if it does make money. Like, just be very clear about that.
Yeah, yeah. No, I've looked, I just looked into it for the sake of knowledge, and it's like, yeah, no, this is a loan. There's a no-interest loan.
Well, they would call it financing.
Financing.
They call it financing. Yeah. This is the term they use. Now, they want it to make money back, but if you don't, they're not going to go after you.
Yeah, because they know the risk that they took.
Right.
Because...
different funding organizations, and I don't want to talk badly of them.
Sure.
They do serve their purpose. But, you know, it's, you know, you have Canada Heritage, right? And you have a heritage minister. And all the money, federally, down to provincially, comes from, like, taxpayers' dollars, right?
Yep.
To say that we have culture here in Canada that is different from the Americans. Our experience, or just what I've noticed, is the way our system is. You know, Americans can easily exploit it for their productions coming up here, which, you know, you can say it's probably a good thing because hires a lot of people, right? But I think we're missing in some degree the supply chain of there's Canadian films out here, you know, going back 5, 10, 20, 30 years, and why can't we find them anywhere?
Yeah.
Right? So... So I don't know. I mean, that's just my
perspective on this. If I'm right, the C-11 bill that's coming.
Sure.
Is that something that's in your orbit?
Yeah. I mean, you know, we've tried to do other things outside of just distribution, just something we've stuck with, like trying to get, you know, popular on YouTube and stuff like that. And I've met other YouTubers just through that process.
That's a wild world, man.
Yeah, it's interesting talking to them. I just feel like, you know, if I was their age, that's probably where I would gravitate towards.
Yeah.
Right? I think it's just generational, right? And I've met some great kind of people doing stuff on YouTube, just interesting stuff. I would just say, you know, I'm, you know, most people in our industry, in the film side, I think are for it.
I'm trying to still decipher the verbiage that they use in Parliament because
sure,
you know, but my understanding is it's designed to force Canadian content to be made for Canadians in a way that protects the Canadian market. If the Americans come here, then if you're going to make it in Canada, then there's more ruling federally now that protects how it's distributed and who it's for. Am I wrong on that?
Well, I think that's, you know, what's the saying? The road to hell is paved with good intentions.
Yes.
I think
mostly politicians are under those cobblestones.
Yeah. I think that's more so. Yeah. Maybe to some degree, sure. But I mean, if you look at why are YouTubers in Canada specifically against this bill, you know,
it hinders their reach.
It hinders their reach. And, you know, I think the problems with kind of what we deal with, and I think you can talk to any filmmaker in Canada who has similar issues to what, you know, they all kind of talk about the same issues. I think you're going to create that system that's been plaguing the film industry for years and years, right? Yeah, I don't know. I mean, just personally,
Also feels like it's government overreach in that I'm telling you what to create and who to create it for, and it's like they don't understand what the aspect of creating online is. Like, I don't know where I even fall into this, and I'm hoping.
Sure, sure.
Like I'm interviewing Canadians when I interview the show, so I think I'm okay. But, you know, where is that for someone whose reach is global? And this, you know, the ministers don't understand that it's the internet. We're not talking about studios and financing Canadian content for CBC and CTV and global. We're talking about the rogue side of things now.
Well, I think just my understanding of it is, so you have, you know, let's say 10, 15 years ago, you have films being made here in Canada, right? Generally, what would happen is it'd be sold to a broadcaster 2 or 3 years after that. You know, that's it.
Yeah.
Right? Well, Google is a gigantic company, like a gigantic global company, right? I think they're
scary fucking big.
In most countries except places like China and North Korea, right? Maybe other countries as well, too. I don't know. So you have this big company, but the way it's set up is anyone can put content on there. And so it lets the free market decide what people want to watch, right? So, I mean, I think these politicians and maybe the bill has good intention, like, oh, yeah, we're going to, you know, make sure Netflix is, you know, making Canadian content and blah, blah, blah. Well, like, I mean, from my perspective, and I can say that, in terms of streaming platforms, and I'll get into like the different variations of that, there's tons out there, right? So if they're trying to regulate Netflix and Amazon because they're so big right now, like they're just playing a game of whack-a-mole because Amazon, well, maybe not Amazon, but Netflix, does it go the way of the blockbuster in a few years, right?
Yeah, which would be irony to the basic definition of it. The guys who offered to buy Blockbuster then, you know, cave to Disney buying. I don't think they'll go away. I think they'll get bought. I think they'll be purchased by Apple or Disney, and they'll say, you do what you want to do, keep doing it, whatever, we'll funnel shit through you whenever we feel like it, or we'll chop you up and take whatever you made and give you a fair price for it. I think that's the two options.
Yeah, who knows? But they're trying to regulate these streamers, right?
Yeah.
They're going after like the big streamers, and Google just happens to kind of fall on that, even though like YouTube content is dramatically different than what we see on Netflix, which is scripted stuff, right?
Yeah.
So I think it's like, okay, so you're trying to regulate these companies, but like, you know, how many fast channels, how many streaming platforms outside of like these big ones are out there. Are you going to try to regulate them all? That's kind of like insane. It's like they don't quite understand how the internet works.
No, they don't.
The best way to put it.
Like they're creating an invisible border literally on the border of like, okay, now like it's so weird. Like just,
yeah,
I can't compute it. And at the same time, I'm also coming up with a question I want to ask you. In the world of, like, my understanding, and here, we'll play a game of correct me where I'm wrong, and you, it won't last too long. I understand you make a film, and you can either distribute it through your company or
sure.
what you guys did. You mm-hmm. go and sell it.
Yep.
It gets out there. They have the rights for, what, 2 years, right? Maybe a year? Like, what do you... It varies.
I mean, there's nothing wrong about your assumption. You're on the right track. It varies. So we sign... They'll give you an idea. We sign with filmmakers non-exclusive, means they own the rights to their film. However, if somebody goes after them legally, we have a hold harmless agreement, which just means like, hey, you know, you didn't get rights to that song, for example.
Yeah, okay.
And somebody's going after you. Like, that's not our problem, that you should have told us when you signed this agreement.
Yeah, yeah.
So, like, there's, that's kind of what we sign. Generally, we sign it because we will go out there and try to make sales on their behalf, and then they get a percentage, and then we keep a commission of what we make.
Now, what's your world like? Because you probably would sell to networks before, right? You would go... Like, if this film, you would distribute it out to, I don't know, this is what I know. I know Showcase has the rights before Disney Plus to play Star Wars every Christmas Day, right? You get those three movies back to back. And then ad money's made while that's playing. So my question is, how does distribution change for you in the world of streaming now? Like, how has that rocked the boat? Because it's interrupted the physical media.
Sure.
Which is a huge part of what you like, you brought one of the ones we're going to talk about today, right?
Sure,
and
sure.
I'm just like, what is this thing? Oh, it's a DVD, right? So, like, how has physical media in the distribution world with streaming changed?
Well, it's a good question. I think there's a lot of answers to that. Just to clarify,
sorry if I cut you off.
No, it's quite all right. Don't worry about it. we kind of came on doing the distribution, and we had just started with streaming. In terms of like how it was done previously, yeah, you would try to sell it to a broadcaster, and then they would
do what they want with it.
Do what they want, and you would sell it for like a fee or whatever, and varying degrees. Sometimes broadcasters would come in, and you'd get money from one of the financiers, and you'd have a broadcaster on board already. So it depends on the level of the film itself.
Yeah, they want the film; mm-hmm. they'll buy it.
They'll invest into it.
Yeah, because
before production, right?
Nice,
right? So that's generally how a lot of films get made in this country. Like, so there's like distributors of varying sizes here. Let's just clarify that. So we take films when they're done. We're dealing with micro budget independent films. We like to take older films because we just like to restore.
It was so nice to find stuff I've never seen and that
that's
I'm
great.
Looking very forward to looking at. Cause I'm like, I'm like, give me original content. Give me some weird story. That's what I want. I'm fucking Superman'd out.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's great. That's great. No, I'm glad to hear that. So that's what we do. I'm going to say another distributor out there in Ontario is Elevation Pictures, and they're a fairly large distributor in the space here in Canada. And generally, I mean, they do a lot of taking something like Everything Everywhere All at Once, putting it in theaters in Canada. But, they've been around for a very long time, or I should say the kind of principals. The company, I think, has been around for a few years. But the people running it, they've been in distribution
yeah.
a very long time, right? So what happens with them, there'll be certain Canadian films that they will invest in before it goes to production, and it'll get financed through a larger something like Telefilm, which is like the primary financer.
Yeah, right? Yeah, yeah.
So there's varying degrees of distributors, and right now we're just...
I noticed that while I was researching this. There was some that would be like, yeah, we want, here's 500 grand, we're in it, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
then
exactly.
we're gonna pump it out the back end, or, all right, I'll buy your finished movie, like you guys do.
Yeah, and we... necessarily in the position to buy stuff yet, we're sharing the sales we make, right? So there's different models of how it works.
Wow, that's so great. And it obviously changes based on the project, right? Like, is it better to do it this way? Like, is that what you're saying, where you're constantly evolving? Where
there's no right or wrong way. I couldn't say like, yeah, do it this way and you'll magically make a ton of money, or do it this way and you won't make a ton of money. There's really no right or wrong way. The distribution we're doing is, there's no term for it, I don't believe, But we're taking existing content, we're selling it, we're monetizing it, we're making sales off of it, right? Or trying to, or really pushing hard to make sales.
Yeah.
So that's what we do, and that's kind of like our business model of what we're trying to do. And that comes from, you know, years of doing stuff at the film group and seeing films that would get shown once or twice. You know, have premiere with friends and family. And after that, it's like
death.
Done, right? Right. And not to get too much into it, because I think there was a time, and I don't know for certain, there was a time, I think, and sometimes, unfortunately, a lot of times with these Canadian films, there's some we would like to get and put back out in the world, but they're tied up with, you know, a distributor that doesn't care to do anything with it.
But doesn't want to let the rights go.
Well, they signed like a 25-year term or something crazy, right?
That, okay, so this is great because you, there's a lot of gems. There's a lot, I can imagine the blood and sweat that you put into like the back and forth of finding stuff in the search. Like how does, what do you get up? You have coffee, you go to work. Like where do you start your search? Where are you looking? Is more of this people come to you? Or are you out there and you, like how does your day go? Because I want to know how you found some of the ones we're going to talk about.
Sure, sure. How we found a lot of the films we've put out. I mean, you know, working in the film group, I knew a lot of filmmakers, so a lot of Winnipeg films, I just happen to know the people.
Sure.
But some of the other ones outside of Manitoba, we were talking to Telefilm. I don't think we got money for something. Just complaining to them. And, you know, there's really good people that work there. And
so you said Telefilm?
Telefilm.
Telefilm, sorry.
Yeah. We're talking to Telefilm, yeah. It's the new, have you heard of it before? It's the new organization. Telefilm, which is, again, the primary funder here in Canada, right? They're across the country.
Yeah.
So they're the federal agency. We were talking to them and we were just complaining. We didn't get money for something. And the guy we're talking to, I said, you know, movies that get financed by Telefilm, they have to, as per agreement with them, send a copy to the archives in Ottawa. So
interesting.
Yeah, so
to protect the film, right?
Protect like historically
our own Criterion collection.
Yeah, it's interesting that I know in Los Angeles, I mean, various large companies like Paramount have a vault or something. I mean, they're probably all trying to digitize it and put it on servers now, I imagine. I don't know.
I know Warner Brothers has it on servers because when Warner Brothers axed Batgirl, it was taken off the server before anybody had a chance to look at it.
Yeah, that's a whole other crazy story.
Yeah, I'll ask your opinion on that in a minute, but go on.
Anyways, so we reached out to the archives. They're very great to deal with, very friendly. And you can go on their website, and there's a list of films, what elements are there. So Craig and myself, we just wrote down this list of films we were interested in acquiring.
Oh, wow.
And we, we're still actively going through that list. If you go to our website, I could point out, you know, this one came through, like, somebody knew the filmmaker. This one came because I got in contact, you know, because it was in the archive list. But when you distribute a film, you have to get in contact with the rights holder.
Okay.
And, you know, and then the archives has to have that, like, you know, the rights holder gave you the agreement to, you know, get into an agreement or a license agreement or whatever.
They okayed it, yeah.
They have to okay it first, right? So that's how we found a lot of the films here. I wouldn't say all of them. Some of them, you know, Craig and I are cinephiles, and we just know, like, you know, what this film that was shot in, you know, Winnipeg in 2001 or, you know, I'm just going to bring up The Nature of Nicholas because I worked with Jeff Urbach, who was the filmmaker of that. It's a film I'm very fond of. And just, you know, get in contact with the producer, was also named Jeff, and get in contact with them, and they're like, yeah, you know, sure, because their distributor is no longer, basically, they were working with. I think they did a pretty good job with it. And so, yeah, it was just a bit of a grind. You know, you get different reactions. The kind of reactions you get are, you know, they are interested in working with you, which is what you want, obviously. You know, just non-responses. Typical, right? And the one that always kind of floors me is, you know, they don't want their film out there, or they're embarrassed by their film.
Interesting.
Which happens more often than you think.
I don't have a hard time believing that, actually. I believe that because sometimes films are made too early.
Sure.
Sometimes they're made way too late.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's why cult classics that fail at the theater become, you know, they live on. And so sometimes people miss their mark with their film, and they might be like, well, you know what? Now's not the time to distribute this. There was a time. And I imagine films from, like, that's why Disney's putting up crap on Peter Pan. Well, not crap, but like a heading. I watched Peter Pan the other night, and I was floored at how much ignorance is in that animation. But now that you're putting stuff up, so some people I would imagine might not want their film out now because they don't want the attention.
Well, there's that. And sometimes I've read some of the descriptions of these films in the archives, and I can't find the people associated with them. And it's just like, was this a terrible vanity project?
Now you really want it.
Yeah, no, those are the ones I really want, because they're just like bizarre oddities, or they're just like terrible movies, but, you know, they're like interesting to watch.
Yeah.
And then the other one is, you know, it's an issue with like song rights or clearances for something, right? There's a lot of times when, you know, why isn't something not out there? For example, I, you know, have a friend who's going kind of on Facebook. There's a TV show that was made here that you can't find anywhere.
What was it called?
I don't want to say.
Okay.
I just don't want to say.
Got it.
But you can't find it anywhere. And I know there's some, like, I think with the opening song is like a relatively well-known song. So the company probably doesn't want to pay the song rights again.
Even though they paid it once, they got to pay it every time. Oh, I guess
depends on the term. Was it for 5 years? Was it for 10 years?
Right? Yeah. Okay. Cause that makes sense. When I bought the intro song to the show, I get it for 50 years.
Yeah. I mean, you get all kinds of, you know, generally I don't think, although some people try to do this legally, as far as I know, and I'm no lawyer, you can't sign these distribution contracts saying in perpetuity.
Yeah, that's on you. That now you're owned by them.
Yeah, exactly.
That's not right. We stopped owning people back after the Civil War ended. Like, that's not cool.
But it's a bit different, say, if a production company paid to make the film or TV show or whatever.
Yeah, because now they own it, so right. Technically they can distribute it in perpetuity.
Legally, they own it, right?
Oh, that's a dirty loophole.
But if you're ever one, I mean, like, people don't.
But I mean, okay, yeah.
People don't get excited about when talk films. They don't necessarily want to talk about, like, oh, you know, the legality of that song. I don't think they had the rights to it. Like, no one cares too much, right? They're just like, why the fuck is this movie not anywhere?
Yeah.
Right? That's what they're thinking. Yeah, you know, yeah. Most cinephiles are like, I just want to see that movie.
Yeah. And we have this big machine called the internet, and that, like, it's like the same old story. All the big shiny things are there, but the ones that require a little bit of polish and a little bit of love and a little bit of patience to find, they just get forgotten by the wayside. And it's like, you know, the loss of physical media is the loss of a lot of this shit, I think.
Yeah, it's an interesting observation for sure. I know with the internet, you know, you can find like movies, but you might find like a crappy version of it.
Yeah.
Like some obscure movie. I know for some of our movies, we have to do the copyright claim on channels.
Okay, what's that?
Well, like, you know, if you have a piece of content that's yours and somebody's put it on YouTube being transformative, so there's no fair use to it.
Yep.
Like, films of ours
have like, ended up
on YouTube, which you can put the copyright claim in, and then YouTube by law has to take that video down.
Yes.
So there's that. And then in terms of physical media, I mean, you know, we've dealt with physical media before. You're dealing with a very niche market these days.
It's like vinyl.
It is exactly like vinyl. It's a great comparison.
You know, like it's always going to have, it was the net to, if you had a bad run in the theater, you'd make it up on DVD sales, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because everybody it's the collectible and it's the behind the scenes and the special features. I just wonder if, like, will streaming hold up enough? Like, I love Tubi. You've mentioned Tubi a couple times.
Yeah, and it's great for filmmakers. People seem to like it. And just very quickly, so there's different models of streaming that would be called AVOD, Advertising Video on Demand.
Okay.
Meaning that the revenue is all coming from, you know, are more people watching it, then more ads are served on that content.
Okay.
And that's how the revenue is made.
So these things that Netflix says when they're like 280 million hours watched, does that Do you have a fix on their algorithm or what's telling them that this is working, that this isn't working? Like, because you deal with streamers now,
mm-hmm.
What's that world like? Do they pull the curtain back for you guys at all?
Not necessarily. It depends on the platform, really.
Really.
I mean, I can speak for Netflix because sure. You know they're hard to sell stuff to, and they're generally doing it through third parties for the most part.
Really.
Yeah. I mean, unless you knew somebody there or something along those lines, or, we might work with more experienced distributors to
sure. Yeah.
Make introductions and stuff like that. Cause we do work with other distributors. But yeah, it depends on the platform. Some will show the time stream. Some just show the revenue that you've made, but there's no correlation between, how many minutes are being streamed or stuff like that. Some pay well, some pay pennies. But they all do it in a way that they're not paying you up front, so there's no risk to them, right?
Yeah, if this flops, we just take it off. Where if it flops, it's like, I wanted something from this. Thanks, guys.
Yeah, well, I mean, even like if it's not doing well, they'll just generally leave it on there.
Yeah, it goes into Netflix, the drain of Netflix at the bottom.
Yeah, I mean, Netflix is...
Is there a bottom?
I don't know. I couldn't speak to their business model per se. We don't have stuff on Netflix or Disney Plus. Obviously, that's a very branded kind of streaming platform, right? Like, we're mostly dealing with AVOD, TVOD, stuff like that. But it's not a risk to them to have that content on there. They're not necessarily paying for it, put it on a server, whatever.
Yeah.
I can't speak to these companies' internal workings. I don't think it's costing them much, if at all.
It's a server farm.
Right, so that doesn't really
particularly
matter to them. More content they bring on, the more ads they can serve, and that's how they're making their money, to my understanding.
Let's switch back to the work that you've done. I imagine that having the archives at your disposal has been very interesting, where you get to pick and choose instead of hope for the next one to be something that you like. Like, you're actively searching things that interest you, which in this game must be a lot more fun than just the business of, like, yes, let's distribute this, right? Like, you're a fan of what you're getting.
Yeah, I mean, for the most part, we try to be as selective as we can with the films we take. Really depends on the situation. I mean, with the archives, yeah, we just have a long list of films. I mean, sometimes we've talked to people, didn't quite work out.
What are some of your, let's talk, can we talk? Can I say the name now that you've got it, the one you brought?
Oh, yeah, sure. Go right ahead.
Okay, so that's something that you'd mentioned to me that you'd been working on.
Yeah, sure.
The Rainbow Boys is the title of the film. So there you go, right there. Put it into the camera for everybody. Was that hard? Was that a mountain for you to climb?
Not necessarily. It was a very good experience. I'll just say a few things here about this. It's a very interesting movie. But it was on the archive list. We called the rights holders. The producer is a gentleman named Murray Shostak, is based in Montreal. And the director, Gerald Potterton, who sadly passed away this past year, was the writer-director of it.
Okay.
And we got to know Gerald, Jerry, as he likes to be called. Gregarious, just a great guy. But I called Murray, and so they said, yeah, we've got this film we made years ago, and if you want to cover the cost of getting it from the archives, you can distribute it. That's fine by us. And so we're very lucky because they're very agreeable to that.
Nice.
And we knew that, okay, first of all, say Craig, my business partner, is a big fan of Halloween. Of course, Donald Pleasance.
Donald Pleasance, front and center on that.
Front and center on there, right?
Yeah. Jimmy's a huge fan of Halloween, too. He would definitely get a kick out of that.
Right. So, we talked to them, got the agreement, got it back from the archives. We had this film. This would have been like 2021. And it was pretty neat because Gerald Potterton, or Jerry, I should say, had directed like a short film with Buster Keaton in it.
Oh, really?
Yeah, which I'll get into in a bit. He directed, I don't know if he was like the main director or what the case was because it's like animation, but he directed Heavy Metal from the 80s.
Jesus.
Yeah, so Jerry is a very accomplished like Canadian filmmaker.
Yeah.
He's from the UK originally. He moved here to Canada.
Across the pond.
Right. So in 2021, we had this movie, and of course the pandemic was kind of going on.
Yeah.
And so...
Just a wee bit.
Yeah. Unfortunately. So most of the theaters were doing this kind of virtual screenings. So we had able to talk to theaters that would take it on. And, you know, unfortunately, that's just me phoning up, are you interested, right? We're still kind of setting up that, I think, aspect of our business where we're trying to do something where we can, you know, pitch it to theaters en masse in this country. Anyways, yeah. So just going in. At the same time, a colleague of mine, she works at Severn Films, which is like one of these like Vinegar Syndrome type labels.
Vinegar Syndrome?
Yeah. Are you familiar with them at all?
No.
No? Okay. Well, that's interesting. I'll get into that.
Okay.
Because I want to get to, like, you know, how this came to be, right?
Yeah.
So there's a lots of, let's just say there's lots of labels, Vinegar Syndrome, Arrow, Severin, and they take old films and restore them. And they're targeting the collector niche market.
The TCM guy, the Turner Classic Movie person, the one who likes the old and the like, how far back do they go?
I mean, it's a lot of genre stuff, okay. Generally. It depends on the label. It's mostly, I'd say, for a lot of these labels, not necessarily. It's more like 70s, 80s, you know, kind of stuff.
The experimental years.
Okay, like horror movies and stuff like that because there's like a demand for it.
Such a resurgence for horror. I'll ask you about that after. Go on.
So we, at the time, I was looking in case we knew we wanted to put this on physical media. Like we did physical media with Dark Forest so we could give back to the... the people who supported our Indiegogo campaign. I was going to say Patreon. So we wanted to do physical media for this, and Craig is very good at putting that stuff together. And so we were just looking for a partner because we just didn't really have the resources to like do it again on our own, which was like a huge undertaking.
Well, now you've got how many people are involved in that little box?
Yeah, so we were very fortunate to be contacted by this label called Arbelos Films.
Okay.
And it's a group of Canadian guys. They're kind of spread over the U.S. and Canada. One's in Toronto, one's in Los Angeles. I think two are in Los Angeles, I should say. And so they contacted us because they were starting a new label called Canadian International Pictures. And so they were taking old Canadian films and put them on physical media. And so they reached out to us. And it was like very serendipitous because we were looking for a partner to work with. And they had done like physical media releases. And so, yeah, we just started talking to them.
Wow, that's a blessing.
And they were cinephiles like us and just had a lot of experience. And so I'm going to say about 2021 to late last year, back and forth, we were just working on getting this thing together between the two of us. They did the majority of the work. I mean, we did the restoration of the film, obviously. The majority of the work on the disc itself, it's under their label. And they did a really good job. I mean, you know, I can't remember the name of the artist, very well-known comic book artist that did this cover.
It's a beautiful cover.
It is. It's really wonderful.
For a DVD, it's a very beautiful cover. It's graphic. It's not poster.
Yeah, and so this is slip cover, which is like very big with the collectors these days, right?
The slip cover, the metal box, or what is it, the steel box? Steel box, they call it.
Yeah, so...
That's so vinyl, man. Like, the price to press a DVD, I imagine, has gone through the roof. And
I have fun trying to find people to press them these days.
Really?
There's not a lot. I mean, the place we used for Dark Forest in 2018, the guy sold the business shortly after we had made our DVDs of Dark Forest there.
Wow.
DVDs and Blu-ray, I should say.
The DVD is going to go the way of the bookstore and the music shop.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, people are collecting VHS now, too, so it's hard to say.
Yeah.
There's physical media collectors out there.
Anyways, Canadian International Pictures, the team up, and this lovely gift happens.
Yeah, so this happened. And so this is where it gets to Vinegar Syndrome, which is if you are a cinephile, you've probably heard that name before.
Okay.
But
for shame, Michael. I'm sorry.
So if you go, Canadian International Pictures, they are label partners with Vinegar Syndrome.
Okay.
So Vinegar Syndrome... this is the only place you can buy this right now. It's on their Vinegar Syndrome website.
You had messaged me this. You had said that they were, yes, now in our conversations, I did check a look at this website, and it's like just very like simple. Here's the DVD and then the cost or whatever to get a copy of it. Man, okay. So that's the only place you can find it.
Yeah, that's right now. And I mean, you know, we will eventually do other things with the film. It's all dependent on our agreement with CIP. But right now this is like just available on physical media.
That's awesome. That's purest form right there.
Yeah. I mean, you know, something like this. So some things about the film itself, we talked about Jerry and Gerald, And just kind of like his long history as a filmmaker.
Sure.
You know, CIP had actually put out a release for the Buster Keaton film as well, like Jerry worked on.
Wow.
So, which is called The Railroader, I believe. And so you can get that as well, too.
That's on Vinegar Syndrome.
On the Vinegar Syndrome website. That's through Canadian International Pictures that did the production of the Blu-ray.
They just released that Rami Malek's going to do a Buster Keaton film. They're going to do his biopic.
Yeah, I heard that. That's interesting.
That'll be, I mean, I can see the look, but I mean, Chaplin was good, but that was Robert Downey Jr. I don't know.
I mean, here's the thing. I mean, you know, what's Buster Keaton known for? These insane, daring stunts.
He is the stuntman.
Right. Just like, you know, frightening.
Yeah.
The way they make movies nowadays, to recreate that, it's not going to happen.
No.
Because the insurance companies get in there and stuff like that.
You have to do the stunt that he did without any of the safety and insurance of today.
Yeah.
For that to look legit.
That's not going to be recreated in any way, shape, or form.
No.
Right? So, and I got to wonder, like,
it's going to be a green screen wall and it's going to fall.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting, but to me, it's like, it's not the same.
No. The remake and the reboot, that's a whole different conversation, because any true cinephile will be like, create, make new.
Yeah.
Stop going back to the fucking well and expecting us to fall for it. Because the ones that you really want to make happy, the ones that make noise, can see it coming a mile away.
Mm-hmm.
And it's exhausting. What's the love that you have for this? Like, what is it?
Oh, like,
you keep, because it sounds like this is a lot of work. There's a lot of moving parts. Like, it's the part of the industry that doesn't really have any sort of, not security, but you're up until you're down, and you don't know when you're going to land, kind of thing. That's what it sounds like to me.
Well, yeah, I mean, the trajectory of financial return of any film generally kind of does this. You know,
yeah.
I don't know. To me, I am fascinated by, you know, films and their lifespan, or why they're, you know, there or not there. I'm coming from that as a cinephile, really. And also, I mean, you know, as a filmmaker, and, you know, I think there's frustration that here in Canada is very tough to make a living as a filmmaker. And I don't know if we're, you know, helping to remedy that in some short form. I'm not really sure. Time will tell, obviously.
As an outsider who, A, thank you for exposing me to this, because, I mean, we all have the habit of, you know, you get swayed by the big budget.
Sure, sure.
Right? And I'm horrible for it, but I love anything. I love anything that I'll walk away from and be entertained by.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't care how I get there, how outlandish, how bad, how great, how amazing, how tearful it is. So you looking for the lost relics, you're like the Indiana Jones of Canadian cinema distribution, where you're finding the gems and the things that need a home,
because
they've gone to the archive.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, yeah, it's just, I would say very much it is a kind of a labor of love for myself and my business partner as well, too. And yeah, I mean, just, you know, another reason is we were trying to get, like, productions off the ground, and we were struggling with that. And, you know, we had some small success with Dark Forest, and, you know, why can't we
replicate that,
do this? And, you know, it's constant learning. And we've met some other distributors we've worked with, like CIP, obviously, and there's some films that, you know, come from other distributors. We're just helping them out here in Canada. I think you talk to any other distributor in Canada, or my experience anyways, and I think it's all kind of like, yeah, you know, we do want our films to be seen globally, right?
Well, and, you know, they come up here and they make up here, and then nothing really gets, like, even the crews, you know, like, there's, like, Deadpool shot in Vancouver. There's no mention of Canadian crews, right? Like, you take the talent out of here, but we don't get a place to showcase it, because the Americans of the South, their shadow's so big.
Yeah, I mean, there's that too, but again, a lot of our stuff is on American platforms.
Sure, yeah,
right?
yeah.
So
I think borders in my head.
Yeah, most people do, right? I mean, we're so influenced by American, especially here in this city. I mean, it was like an 8-hour drive to Minnesota, right?
Yeah.
Right, so we're so influenced by, you know, American stuff like this. And I don't have problems with Americans coming here. I just wish, and they don't necessarily all do this, and I can give some examples, give them more positive examples, that if they're coming here, they would give back to the community here. And I give an example, Simon Barrett, who had made The Guest, was involved in Year Next, a bunch of horror movies. He had come here to shoot, I can't remember the name of the movie, a few years ago. But he had actually done like a workshop with a film group, which I attended.
Oh, and so he took some of his spare time.
Exactly.
And was like, here's what it's like down there. I'll bring it up here so you can learn it.
Well, he was just talking
about, or just be exposed to it.
Talking, like, I'm just talking about my experiences because I can't say, like, no one's an expert, right?
No.
And people claim they are, but no one's an expert in this industry. But he was just talking about experiences, and I think that's nice. And, you know, I think it's good when they come and they do stuff like that. And I can't speak to every film that comes up here, and if they may be giving back to the community in other forms.
Yeah,
I don't
sure.
know,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
But yeah, in terms of like, you know, something like this, I'll get back to the Rainbow Boys here. So from my understanding, getting to know and talk to Jerry, you know, it was made in the 70s. So 73, I think. Yeah, 73. Maybe played some theaters. I think it got sold to Canadian like TV at the time. Because you talk to people that are of that generation and grew up during that time, they're like, yeah, I saw this movie all the time on TV. And then I think it kind of died off after that, you know, however long the license terms were. And I don't think it was kind of watched since back then it was released. I think they said they had somebody put it on DVD, but they didn't do a very good job. Yeah, so, I mean, there's a bit of preservation. And also with this, this is a part I really enjoy, is the preservation of the history, because this was actually shot in Lytton, B.C., which is the place where got ravaged by forest fires.
Oh.
In 2020, 2021, I can't remember the year.
Yeah, yeah, the hot, hot summer.
Yeah, so this serves as like a historical artifact of...
of the time of the area, because now it's burnt.
Now it's burnt, right?
Oh, wow. You know? Yeah, see, like, that's the stuff that I think is really neat when you tell me that it just goes to the archive and you're digging and you're trying to showcase. What are some of the hot ones on the site right now that you think people should go check out? Like, what are some of your, besides Rainbow Boys, like, is there like a short list that you think would expose people to the Zelko world?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm just going to give my personal opinion on things because we do short films as well, too.
Yes, you do. You do everything.
Well, it's,
isn't there docs on there, too?
There's documentaries, but it has to be Canadian produced.
Yes,
so,
yeah,
like,
yeah.
That's like our stipulation. You have to produce. And we don't tend to take more experimental films. We'll try to find, you know, another distributor in Canada that's more suited for, you know, if it's like more experimental, like,
yeah.
it's not really kind of like our world, really. But just off the top of my head, I mean, just personal kind of like, what would I recommend? I'm partial to the documentaries myself. You know, if you're here in Winnipeg or Manitoba, there's the Manitoba Connection, which is like about the kind of punk and hardcore scene in the mid-2000s.
Yeah, didn't they shoot that at, what's the bar downtown, the punk bar that they all...
Oh, the Albert.
That was shot at the Albert,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, a lot of footage
from
the Albert.
I heard about that. It's there. Okay, now I know where to watch it.
Yeah, it's on Tubi, I believe. A lot of stuff is on Tubi, which is free to watch, which is great, of course. I'm trying to think what else here. I mean, I personally like Grilled Cheese Sandwich. Very low budget, kind of punk type thing. It depends, because I mean, like, we have, you know, stuff from like a diverse group of filmmakers. Like, I go and say, like, oh yeah, check this film out, it's the best, right? It's your personal preference. We have Time Sleeper, which is a faith-based sci-fi film, right?
That genre.
Yeah, that genre. It was very unique, right? It comes from a black filmmaker and is, you know, very talented. So, you know, there's that particular film, which a lot of people have seemed to enjoy. A Desperate Row, which you, I believe, watched and enjoyed.
I liked it. I was sucked right in. And I mean, beyond knowing Crystal and Cam, I mean, mm-hmm. I watched it and I knew of Crystal. I have my friends of the show were friends with her, but after, yeah, no, I thought that was very, I was like, shit, I can't believe that actually happened.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, if you like thrillers or stuff like that, I mean, yeah, there's a lot of stuff. And then
I love the story about the ADR, Desperate Road, that they tell you.
I've heard. Yeah,
fix most of the audio in post.
Yeah, I mean that's just a hassle, really.
Fuck.
You know, that sucks for them. I feel for them having to deal with that.
I didn't know when she told me that after. I was like, you can't tell. Like you can't tell, and even if you're looking, you can't tell. So.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's all kinds of tons of stuff on our website, which I'd recommend. I'm going to say one film I think that is going to be released on Vimeo and Gumroad this Friday.
Nice.
We'll pitch it to more platforms, of course. But I just think it's a great film. If you get a chance to watch it, definitely do. It's called Camera Shy. It's a BC film.
Okay.
Came out in 2012. It's a comedy. The guy who directed it, Mark Sawyer, has directed like a number of Kids in the Hall segment back in the day.
Yeah.
And the comedy is about, or the film itself, is about this politician and very kind of sleazy guy.
Not a hard stretch, not a hard sell.
Yeah, so anyways, the performance is really good by the lead guy, Nicholas Ray is the name of the actor. But anyways, he starts thinking that a cameraman is following him around. And so it kind of starts off, he's, you know, cheating with his wife, and this is where the cameraman shows up. And just kind of everything kind of gets worse and worse for him. And it just keeps getting kind of like more hilarious and kind of.
And everything's on camera.
Everything's on camera. But like, they play it straight, so the humor is very like natural. Yeah. And like, the performance is very natural. Like, he's just got very good like reactions and looks to like, you know, goes to the psychiatrist's office. I think it's in the trailer. Where he's like, oh, the psychiatrist, oh, was the cameraman over there? He's like, no, he's over there now. And it really plays with the conventions of, like, filmmaking and stuff, too. It's a very clever film. Came out in 2012, or it was made in 2012, played, like, Vancouver, a bunch of other film festivals, won a bunch of awards in BC, like their equivalent of whatever the award show out there, the Leos, I believe it's called.
Yeah.
I think the producer is telling me she dealt with a company called Gunpowder and Sky. You know, I think it was in a few places. Didn't really get kind of any attention, unfortunately, which is too bad because it's a great little film. I think it played on a broadcaster at the time, too. But yeah, it's coming out. I'd really recommend it. It's a very funny film. But that's just something I want to plug because it's a newer film.
Yes. No, please do.
But generally, you know, go to our website because our website's a bit more consumer facing, let's just say.
Yeah.
Where you can find
it's designed to watch.
Films. Yeah, where you can find other films and where to watch them, so definitely.
Yep.
But Camera Shy is a very funny movie, and I'll make another recommendation because this is like a personal favorite. And I know Nick, the filmmaker, is probably going to listen to this. So. Hi, Nick. Nicholas Klebon, I think that's how you pronounce it. Anyways, this film called The Kingdom of Var.
I started watching it, sir. I had to stop because I was just too hungover, but you have my attention.
Well, you should have kept watching it. I'm going to cure your hangover, quite honestly. I don't even know how to describe it. It is just so insane. You have to watch it to see it. If you're familiar with like Tommy Wiseau's The Room.
Oh, yes.
It's a good comparison in terms of that. And we think at some point this film will get noticed. And I mean, to some degree, it has here in Winnipeg, even though the film was made in Hamilton. Because our friends at the Cinematheque, they played it as part of the Cream of, or I guess... Our friends at Cream of the Crap, they screened it at Cinematheque, part of Cream of the Crap, and it had a pretty strong reaction there.
like walkouts, or like where
well, people are there because the films they know are like, you know, it's called Cream of the Crap for a reason, right?
Yeah, sure.
But just like, you know, howling at certain parts, or you know, just
like the spoons in the room, or
it's
an involved performance.
Yeah, it's the girl who plays the lead. She's it's quite the performance to watch.
Yeah, she's great. That's what kept me. Like, that's what I'm interested in.
She's a fascinating human.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, she is. She's her mannerisms are like, I couldn't turn my eyes away.
Yeah. And so that's one of the, you know, some of the genre films, we put that on DVD, and my friend James, who does Cream of the Crap, just recently, he's the VHS collector. He put it on VHS.
Oh, nice.
So I'll give a plug to Cream of the Crap. Cause if you go this February, you can get yourself a VHS copy of The Kingdom of Var.
Okay, yeah, I'll put the link in the show notes.
So. 10 copies in the world, because they've only made 10 so far. So. We've sold, I think 3 have sold so far. So.
Nice. Well, that's how you create the value, right?
Exactly.
Get it out to the people. You sent me your, before I let you go here, you sent me your letterbox, which was great. Like, all you would not believe how many people on the show use letterbox.
I'm sure.
No, it's embarrassing how much of us don't. Like, I told the guys about it the other day, and they're like, what? You can see what your other friends watched, and then you can see what they thought of it, then you can go watch it, because you're more inclined to watch something someone you know recommends than someone you don't.
I mean, you know, there's certain type social media tracks, but I do enjoy it for the most part.
Oh, yeah. It's you know what? I like it because it curates and keeps.
Yeah, yeah.
And I can go to it for reference for stuff. Like, it's very streamlined in that aspect, but it is designed for, the internet. Oh, where's the link here? Hang on. You watched a movie though that I saw in the newspaper that's made by a Manitoba filmmaker.
Oh, yeah. Social. Yeah, yeah.
Please tell me about that. I it's on my list, and we watch a lot of the same stuff, but I saw that you watch Social. I have said for the longest time someone needs to do something with a Social. It's so inherently Manitoban. How is that film?
It's great. It's great. Yeah, I've been talking to the filmmaker. I don't want to say anything, you know, if we work with them or not, right? But I enjoyed it. I just went to the cinema. And yeah, it's great, you know, first time film. Like, I think there's a lot to admire about it.
Is it scripted or is it doc? It's scripted.
Okay. Like, the writer director plays the lead character, and
yes,
it's like a series of vignettes, and he's just going around trying to get people to go to his mom's, I guess, remarrying, and they're having a social, like, for his mom and soon to be stepfather.
I don't want to get married in this province because I don't want to have to put one on for my friends.
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, you know, I think the lead performance and you know, this character and his motivations, I think, are very clear, which is always good. And it's nothing too complicated, which I think a lot of first time filmmakers get in the trap of, like,
how much do I put in?
Watch these B films and the you know, you watch these films and this is like the story's all over the place. But it's very funny too, you know, and not like any crude or vulgar or cheap humor. The humor is all very earned.
Nice.
Which I think is very good.
Because it is something of, it's kind of kooky that we do this and it's here,
yeah,
right? You know, like it's almost like, you want me to pay for your wedding and then pay to go to your wedding? Right. Mm-hmm. Like, a lot of it can set the hair on their necks up a little bit. And I get that. But at the same time, they're so weird to not have something in and around it. I was like, what's happening in this province?
It's very funny in the film because I think it is a nice thing where, you know, the main character is very optimistic, but yet the sense that, you know, he's maybe a bit aloof. Right. And is a thing about
useful,
like,
idiot.
Yeah, I think to some degree, yeah, sure, I would say that. And, you know, there's a thing of, like, desperation of, you know, selling these social tickets to people, and they're kind of like, oh, you know, I got other plans, or, you know.
So he's playing into the trope of it all.
Yeah, yeah, it's very clever.
Okay, cool. I'm going to check it out. Because as soon as I saw that in the paper, I actually took a picture. I've got it. I wanted to contact him and be like, come on the show. Let's talk about how you researched making a...
Yeah, you should, I mean...
I'll talk to anybody, man.
I've been talking to him. I'll certainly put you in contact with him.
Oh, that would be like great. Yeah, for sure. No, I will. I will definitely take you up on that. But you also watched a documentary that I recently watched this past weekend. The hitchhiking.
Oh my god!
The
hatchet wielding hitchhiker.
The hatchet wielding hitchhiker. Okay, go. What did you think of that?
What an absolute pile of garbage. I mean, honestly.
It's to the point that they're making documentaries like that because they know people like watching train wrecks. Like, we're not like, it's not like, it's enjoyable in the fact that I'm glad that this guy was an idiot and just didn't like skate by and got busted. But at the same time, like, it's just a shit show.
Well, okay, here's my issues with the doc. I don't think he's an idiot per se. He has some very serious mental health issues, right?
The sociopathic tendencies that he was exuding is the right word.
Exuding. Yeah. So he's a very mentally, he's got some mental health issues. I'm not going to speak on that. I don't know his situation. That's not clear. But the documentary is about, you know, the producer of the Kardashians can't figure out how to exploit him, which is so gross to me.
It was really disgusting to see how they all jumped on him so fast.
Oh, yeah.
It's like, what really? Like, really? I get that he's famous for his 15 minutes for what he did, but to try to stretch that and then to string him out on that, like, you know that you're going to turn him into some fucking reality TV bullshit.
Yeah, so there's that whole aspect, which I found very gross. But the other thing about this, too, is so anything on the internet, and I tend to watch a lot of stuff on YouTube because I think it's just very interesting to me.
Yeah.
You can find probably endless YouTubers talking about this whole thing years previous to this documentary being made. So, like, you know, another thing, this documentary is like 10 years too late.
It is. It did miss the boat.
Like, what is the point of this, really?
Well, and that's when I put it in, like, the Fyre Festival category of we like watching people be fucked up, get fucked up.
Sure.
Not come back from being fucked up. Mm-hmm. Like, it's the shitty thing about humanity, right? Like, it's the looky-loos. It's the train wreck. It's the burning car. We can't turn away. And I think Netflix is overtly capitalizing on that. And they found it from the Tiger King, I think, is what really showed everybody during the pandemic that we will eat this stuff up.
Well, yeah, I like watching documentaries. I thought the Tiger King was an interesting docu-series.
It does come around and redeem itself, totally.
It is interesting, and I think it was fairly well made.
Carol Baskins.
But, you know, there's just so much documentary stuff on Netflix, and it's not like they're hiring Errol Morris to make these movies, you know?
They look really good.
Yeah, they're very slick. You know that one movie that this and the other, the Tinder Swindler was another one.
Yes.
And this, it's like they do this thing where there's B-roll of, you know, Instagram, you know, and all that
text
stuff.
Bubbles.
Yeah, it's just like, you know, I think people know how this works, right?
Yeah, we don't need to see it. Thank
so
you very much.
So it's very kind of like dumbing it down in your face.
Oh, very much so.
Which I find very irritating. And I've seen good Netflix documentaries. That wasn't one of them, unfortunately. You know, I watched the Woodstock 99, which I thought was very interesting.
It was, because when you think you hear the Woodstock 99 documentary, you think you're going to hear about Woodstock 99, but you hear about toxic masculinity, and you hear about the over-sexualization of the 90s, and you hear about corporate greed, and those are all of the takeaways. I like that way more than being like, oh, look, there's Bush back on stage and there's a nostalgia bomb. I was like, these are fucking assholes who thought putting Bush on after...
was it Limp Bizkit?
No, it was Creed, fuck.
That 90s band?
That 90s, thank you. Yeah, that 90s band, whatever. But it was some crazy ass-kicking loud metal band, and then they were like...
Glycerin. Oh, well, I think it was after Korn, right?
That's it.
Yeah.
Thank
right,
you.
Right.
Not K. C. Kissy K. Whatever. But yeah, no, I was really blown away at how well they did that documentary.
So yeah, there's good stuff on there, but you compare that to the Hatchet Wielding Hitchhiker. And so the Woodstock 99, they talked to the organizer, was like one of the guys who also did the original Woodstock.
Yes.
And the guy contracted. So you get, you know, all the different aspects of the perspectives where this hitchhiker, they're just talking to people that were
enamored by him,
trying to exploit this guy. And then they talk to the family, which becomes very uncomfortable.
It does, when they have to talk to the mom.
And, you know, you don't know what's going on, because they talk to the cousin, and this guy was from Edmonton.
You find out that he's Canadian.
Yeah. And, you know, and the cousin talks about, like, you know, I think there was something going on over there, and the mom denies it. And it's just like, it just feels so exploitive. And
yeah, I totally agree. I did not come away from that being notified of something that I didn't know, and I'm better for knowing. I came away from that feeling like I watched 1,000 Pound Sisters, right? Some sort
yeah,
of like TLC bullshit that, and like, I mean, the reporter was entertaining. He was just a fucking Chad. Like he made me laugh, because he, like, you see him in his videos from when like the story first broke, and you see him now, and I'm like, oh my God, you're trying to hang on to being 30 with your tan and your perfect shave and your suit. Like, that guy was just a tool.
Yeah, I mean, not as bad as some of the producers they talk to of reality shows.
The Kardashian producer is just the worst.
Oh, she was awful. But yeah, I mean, whew.
The guy, the Jimmy Kimmel handler.
Yeah.
Shauna and me were watching it. She's like, that's Drunk Uncle. That's sure. Bobby Moynihan from SNL. That's Drunk, just his mannerisms. And I'm like, oh my God, he's so right. But both of them, like, just, they just talk about how people are commodities. They didn't talk about how he was a human.
I think the thing that bothers me about that too, and you know, if you know anybody who's mentally ill or suffers from a mental illness,
yeah,
you know, they're people, right? And generally, if somebody is saying what he was saying, for me, I would know, okay, there's something with him, and he's got some serious issues.
Yeah, something's rotten in Denmark. Right.
You know, and you got to give people like that some space.
Yeah, no, him with the lights and showing up drunk, I was like, of course he's showing up drunk. He's self-medicating.
Very, you know, traumatized or something in his past. I don't know what it is.
Yeah.
And so to be like just what they were doing is so, I know, so gross. It's interesting to me because like this Netflix documentary is terrible. And I've watched, there's like these YouTube channels that are like doing documentaries that are like superior to this.
Right. And how are they only there?
Yeah. You know, and I mean, you know, they're most self-funded and stuff like this. I'm just going to say this because, you know, we're talking about documentaries and
sure.
This is a terrible documentary. There's a YouTube channel called Atrocity Guide.
Okay.
I just want to recommend this. And this is like a personally, I really like this. There's another guy named Frederick Nunson, I think, Down the Rabbit Hole.
Okay.
Both very interesting channels.
I've heard of Down the Rabbit Hole.
Very good. It's a very good channel. He does very good research on his subjects. And it's all just like, you know, YouTube kind of style or whatever, but
sure.
It's very effective. But Atrocity Guide is this girl, and she does like kind of similar documentary style videos. And her most recent one is a fascinating story I didn't know about this filmmaker in Korea, in South Korea, and was a very well-known filmmaker in the 60s and 70s, and would make movies with his wife. His wife was starring in his movies. And so I think this is like the late 70s, early 80s. His wife, you know, goes to China for some reason. And then she's nowhere to be found. And so he's concerned. So he goes to China. And then he gets kidnapped by the North Koreans.
In China?
In China, yeah.
Okay.
In China, they kidnap him. I mean, watch this video goes into more details, right?
Sure.
So he gets kidnapped in North Korea. And basically, he was kidnapped by Kim Jong-un.
Un?
Is it Kim Jong-un? Kim Jong-il is the son, right?
Something like that.
I can't remember.
I'm not too sharp on my dictators.
Yeah. Anyways, the dictator in North Korea, Kim
sure.
Jong.
Yeah.
Whatever.
The big bad.
There at the time. And basically, he had kidnapped this filmmaker and his wife so they could make films for the North Korean
regime. Propaganda films.
Propaganda film. And yeah, there's, they made a number of films. They eventually escaped. And the one big film they made, Paul Gasori, was like a big kaiju film. Because he always, like Kim Jong...
Love kaiju.
Always wanted to have, like, a kaiju film. Yeah, so they escaped. They eventually went defected to America just because of all this, like, craziness.
Sure.
They dealt with in their lives. And I think they produced those Three Ninja movies. Like, those kids' movies.
Really?
Yeah.
Like, from propaganda film to Three Ninjas.
Yes.
Which was huge. I watched Three Ninjas so many times as a kid.
Yeah, I don't think they did like all of them. I think they did like some of them.
Sure.
But they were trying to get a movie made of the story of their life. And it never happened. But it's such a fascinating story.
Oh my God. That's normal people doing abnormal things. Those are the best documentaries.
Yeah, it's crazy because, you know, some dictator kidnaps you.
Yeah.
To make films for his regime because the films previous, in his opinion, were not that good. And he was a cinephile, right? If you didn't know that about Kim, I can't remember which ones. I want to say Kim Jong-il was the dad. And Kim
I Jong-il believe you're right.
Right, so Kim Jong-il is like a huge cinephile.
Listener, give us a break.
Somebody's out there going like, oh, those fucking guys don't know they're dictators.
I'm fine with not knowing that. No, that's cool, man. That's super cool. I'd love to keep you longer. We covered, I think, what we set out to cover. When we don't cover it, we just say come back for another episode.
Yeah, sounds great.
So, anything, www.zelcoentertainment.com?
Yeah, just zelcoentertainment.com. We do have, you know, other films we're trying to do stuff with. I just want to mention The Nature of Nicholas because I think that's a great film. Let's mention this as a last thing.
So is that the one that you were telling me has the like the LGBTQ themes in it? It's a camp, right? Isn't that something that you?
Yeah. So I'll just
Can we give the listener the proper breakdown?
Clarify here. So I've been trying to. It played at Gimli virtually, unfortunately. I've been trying to do something with it, like a restorative screening. You know, it's been tough, right? Because you know, festivals want to play certain films and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But it was made by a filmmaker named Jeff Urbeck, incredibly talented. He's not in film anymore, but he made a number of short films before he was this. All very challenging, all very different, all very interesting. The Nature of Nicholas he had made in 2003, I want to say, was released in 2003. And it is about, you know, they use the term elevated horror nowadays.
Yeah, I think horror plus, elevated horror, yeah.
Whatever. But this is like kind of like in that vein where it's very understated, you know, not in your face. But basically is about a young boy growing up like, you know, in the prairies somewhere.
Sure.
In the prairies, like somewhere in Manitoba.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like the summer and he's attracted to his best friend. And, you know, the best friend develops kind of a zombie doppelganger. But it's all about kind of like his feelings for his young boy and, you know, his sexuality. So there's a lot of interesting themes and stuff like that.
Sure, yeah.
And it's an incredibly well-made film in terms of, like, cinematography, lighting, editing. I think just something that needs to, like, I would love to do the kind of treatment for The Nature of Nicholas like we did with Rainbow Boys.
Yeah, put it nice and close so that I can cut this in. And
so there we go.
All right, over here on over this one. This camera. Yeah, camera two. Huawei camera two. There you go. There perfect. You go.
So, yeah, I would love to do something with that. And it's just something I've been working and we'll see. I mean, it'll probably go eventually to streaming sometimes, but yeah, it seems to be a lot of people, you know, have connected with that movie over the years.
There you go, listener. And all of this will make it nice and easy because I'm a lazy piece of shit. All of these links will be in the notes so that you can start supplementing when there's not some stupid Quantumania coming out into the theater. You can go and investigate Canadian film that this man is so hard working so hard to dig up. There we go. I'll say that.
Yeah,
right.
You know, if you're listening to the show and you're interested, you know, go watch the movie. Leave us reviews on Letterboxd. You loved or hated it, doesn't matter. As long as you're watching it, we appreciate it.
There you go, listener. I will make sure that anything forwarded to us for you, I'll pass it along as well too. That never happens, but if it does, I'll make sure I'll put them in your orbit. Thank you so much for another episode. This is where I don't know how to end the show because it just sucks to end, so we'll see you next time. If this is your first time, the easiest thing to do to join our orbit is to subscribe to our social media. TikTok is gone. It's just Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook, the original big three, Real Debaters Pod, spelled R-E-E-L. That's how you join the Debaterverse. That's how you know what's going on in the world when we're doing live events, when we've got new guests on like Dave, when we're out and about hosting shit. Just subscribe to that stuff, but most importantly, subscribe to the show. That's free. You can do that in your podcast player. Any podcast player allows you to subscribe for free. So if you don't want to shop our merch, if you don't want to join the Debaterverse, just subscribe to the show. We'll be there each and every week, usually on Thursdays, sometimes Fridays if life gets in the way. I have been Michael Petro. Across from me has been David Zales. Did I get that right?
David Zales. Thank you very much for having me on.
Anytime, dude. It was a pleasure.
Peace out, motherfuckers.
Bye, everybody.
Ladies.